This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Really appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are with us live, if you'd like to, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room. Right now, we got Paul Withington standing athwart the quarterdeck, but he'll be glad to take the company if you want to stroll in there. And if you had some observations you wanted to share during the course of the show, or even better, if there were some questions that you wanted to ask our guest, we'll be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we'll be glad to take your good ideas and fold it into the conversation as things go forward. And now for today's show details. With the sequel to Top Gun coming out, I don't think there'd be a better time to bring on a retired TAC Air Bubba and somebody who knows a thing or two about telling a story about naval aviation, and no better time than today. And our guest for the full hour is retired U.S. Navy captain and author Kevin Miller. Kevin is a third-generation naval officer. He graduated from the University of Mississippi and was designated a naval aviator in August of 83. He flew both the A-70 and the F-A-18 Charlie Hornet, and he deployed overseas six times during the 80s and 90s aboard the Nimitz, the Eisenhower, the George Washington, the Theodore Roosevelt, and the Enterprise. He finished his career getting a little bit of payback for all those good tours in the Pentagon, serving as staff for the Secretary of the Navy, leaving active duty in 2005. Today, he's a self-employed defense consultant and Amazon best-selling author of the military action-adventure novels Raven One, Declared Hostile, and the third in the series, Final Flight, that takes place in the South China Sea. Kevin, welcome to Midrats.
Well, thanks so much, guys. It's great to be aboard.
Really appreciate you taking time this afternoon, and it's over the years, we've always had authors on, and I know Mark and I both have people that we talk to offline who want to write, but they won't even write an article for a variety of reasons. And everybody has a story in them, but a lot of people, for a variety of reasons, never take that step to what you've done and done successfully to put pen to paper, get that story that's in your head, and get it out there, especially fiction, which is a different genre in and to itself. And just to start the show off, Kevin, if you could, for the listeners, describe what helped get you from having that story in your head that you wanted to tell to get across the block and actually go forward and write.
Well, Sal, you can imagine, as an aviator, when you get challenged, You want to take up that challenge. So after I retired in 2005, my friend and fellow aviator Dave Wooten said, you should write a book. And I waved my hand at him. Get out. He says, no, I mean it. You should write a book. And whatever. And so I kind of went home and thought about it. And it comes down to, you're at a cocktail party and people find out that you're a carrier pilot. And they say, oh wow, what is that like? And okay, how do you answer that question, without dominating the rest of the conversation? So, I thought, maybe I'll write a book about it. I'll write some vignettes, and it can be fiction, and if nothing else, leave it for the kids. This is what their dad did, back at the end of the 20th century. It took me about 4 years to write Raven One because I would, I would scribble 5,000 words in a weekend, and then in exhaustion, I'd put it down for weeks and months and pick it back up. But when I finally finished it at the end of 2009, I realized, I've got something here. This isn't bad. I talked to my buddy Ward Carroll, who had already broken the code on this with his terrific Punk's War trilogy, and gave me some pointers. And so I started knocking on doors in New York. You got to find an agent first. That's the, I think that's the conventional wisdom anyway. And when an agent would write back, they say, okay, you know, you've got some ability. Keep trying. Maybe you should do this or that, but it's not for me, but keep trying. And now it's 13 or so, and I've met some new friends. One of them, George Galderisi, very prolific author out in San Diego, written several naval aviation pieces. And he introduced me to a guy named Jeff Edwards, who's written a trilogy, surface warfare trilogy. And he said, okay, look, you know, you've got something here. Yes, get it edited and then send it back. So I found a wonderful editor here in Pensacola, Linda Wasserman, and we made that thing diamond hard, ready to go. And Raven One was published in June of 14, and it's still a genre bestseller. It's doing great, and it resonates with people. It's basically vignettes. It's all right. Here is a carrier launch. Here is an air-to-air engagement. Here is a air-to-ground. And I built it into what was going on at the time. You know, in the late 2000s with the surge in Iraq, and I wanted to tell a current story of something that's happening today. So that's how it all started. And you know, my editor said, okay, you know, you've written a book. Congratulations. Now you got to get started on the next one. And yeah, she was right.
Yeah, and thank goodness she was right, because nice thing is I was a surface warfare guy, so I didn't know all the things you guys were doing in those airplanes. I just thought it was cool. You got to be flying around and getting plenty of crew rest. And the nice thing about Raven One is you went into detail without overwhelming the reader on what is going on in the cockpit when you're busy doing stuff. And since one of my sons is a Rhino pilot, F-18E Echo pilot, I didn't know what he was doing in his cockpit. But so it was really a useful experience and read for me to get what you put in the book, what goes on through the pilot's mind as he's flying into combat situations. And you turned it into a good story, too. So a very pleasurable read. I was fascinated by the way you've approached these books, though. You've got three what if scenarios. Let me correct a Sal too. The last book is called Fight Fight, not Final Flight, which I think is a Stephen Kuntz book. But
it is, yes, very good.
Yeah, so Fight Fight. You've got three scenarios. You've got the Iranian, kind of an Iranian punitive expedition. You've got a South America Caribbean thing in the second book, which is what is the second book? Raven 2, whatever though.
Declared
and the third, yeah, and the third one is a South China Sea scenario. Is that how you mapped this out when you started writing these books? I've got these things, these situations that would be interesting both to me and to the reader, and let's see how they work out.
I did not. You know, Raven One was published, and I had no idea what was going to happen. But within weeks and months, reviews started coming in, and they were glowing. And wow, you know, and Amazon is you know, taking good care of an author like me. You know, Amazon takes in the way this works, and this is there's no secret about this. Amazon takes 30% of the retail price, and the rest belongs to the author. And so, you know, Kindle downloads, you know, X times a day, it adds up. So, wow. I mean, you know, people like this. So, so yes, I took the advice of my author, and I said, okay, you know, what else? What else could I do? Okay, I spent a lot of time in the Caribbean in my career, you know, back when we used to go down there for you know, ref tray and the ORE and all that Cold War jargon that we love before we go on cruise. And so I, you know, this war on drugs, how are we doing on the war on drugs that we've been fighting for 30 years? And you know, arguably no change today than it was 30 years ago. And just a if just a fraction of what is sent up north gets through, then billions of dollars and billions, tens of billions each year with a very minor overhead. So I thought, you know, what if the United States took the gloves off and really fought this war? And so that was the impetus of that. And then with Fight, I thought, okay, I spent a lot of time, you know, off Norway and, you know, the Atlantic and Mediterranean, and maybe we'll get, you know, Russia is in the news, of course. So I bounced it off some friends that said, no, the South China Sea. That's where the action is. That's what you need to study. So I did a lot of research. I was always a Atlantic fleet sailor. And I thought, okay, what if, you know, what if just like in 1914, you know, there was an assassination in Sarajevo. And, you know, that might have been on page, you know, 10 of the New York Times back then. You know, who cares? You know, and no Americans cared about that. But, you know, years later, here we are in the Great War, the war to end all wars, over that incident. So, you know, in human history, that's how wars start.
In the intro to the show, we kind of teased the fact that it's true. Top Gun is coming out. And we also have, even though the Top Gun is a sequel, they're remaking Midway. And it had me thinking that when you look at what Hollywood has done, but also your books and other authors, that naval aviation always seems to outshine land-based sister over in the Air Force. And not that there aren't any good stories. For instance, I'm still gobsmacked the fact that nobody has put a screenplay based upon Robin Olds, at least in Vietnam experience, but his entire story is interesting in and to itself. But as somebody who obviously we have our partisanship, but why do you think naval aviation from a entertainment point of view just seems to have a little more zing to it, if you judge books written and movies made, than the Air Force?
Sure. And there was after Top Gun came out in the 80s, you guys remember there was a spate of shows on TV, you know, that tried to piggyback on that. And then there was JAG, you know, the pilot that turned Jack. I think to answer that, I think the romance of the sea, there's still something to be said for that, you know, to go over the horizon on a ship and you're flying off that ship day and night. I mean, that's pretty cool. And, you know, our friends in the Air Force, God bless them. They've got that nice, you know, 10,000 foot runway, and they would say, yeah, it is nice. And, you guys, you know, go ahead, have fun out there. But, that, you know, the challenge of operating off the ship and going to, you know, on our deployment, you know, you're going to several different parts of the world. I think there's something for that. And maybe, the dressed blue uniform, might help too.
One of the things that in your book I think that is emphasized, and people tend to forget about Top Gun, which is it's a training environment. Can you kind of talk about the amount of training that our naval aviators go through and why it's as strenuous as it is?
Oh, yes. You know, Top Gun was formed 50 years ago. In Miramar, California, and we Naval Aviation Carrier Aviation was not doing well over North Vietnam, and you know, in our F-4 Phantom interceptors, and hey, you know, we gotta pass the word to the guys on how to maximize, you know, what this airplane, this is our airplane, it's all we got, and you know, how we best fly it. So those guys, they you know, using really the standardization that you'll find in NATOP's safety training to standardize the way you would fight the F-4 Phantom and the F-8 Crusader of the day. And, of course, 50 years on, you know, the various airplanes that have come through and various enemy threats and guys are experts on this, and pretty incredible. when I came up in the A7, there was certainly professional briefing and debrief. You know, every aviator is gonna brief. I mean, that's on day one. You learn, okay, this is what we're going to do, and then you go out and do it, and you come back, and you're gonna get critiqued. It's constructive criticism, and sometimes it's you got to put your big boy pants on and say, okay, I got to do better. But at least you're finding out through the debrief what you need to work on. Top Gun elevates that. And then Fallon, Nevada, where Top Gun is now, they moved from Miramar in the 90s. You'll go out and in a Top Gun scenario, let's say it's a 1v1, early in the program. And you're flying a Super Hornet and you're going to go against whatever you're going to go against. And it might be 45 minutes. You just go out there and you're an afterburner for a lot of that time, 2-3 engagements. You come back and land and you'll talk about it for the next 3 hours. And you'll go over every little, to include pre-flight preparation and then just, how energy was managed and mismanaged and shot parameters. And then they'll go back that afternoon and do it again. And it goes, the scenarios get bigger. Okay, now it's 2v many. It's 4vx. And you got a Top Gun patch, and I don't have one, but you've got a Top Gun patch on your shoulder. You are somebody, and you are an expert. That has transferred into the fleet in a way that we can talk about now. The Air Combat Training Continuum, and many that are familiar with naval aviation in my former community, the Strike Fighter Training and Tactics Instructor. This program came about in the mid-90s, and it was really a confluence of Air Force, Marine Corps, and Navy fighter pilots that found their way into the FA-18 community. There are A-7 guys like me. There were Marine Corps F-4 guys that went to the Hornet, and then F-14 guys, many of them went to the Hornet. And then we get some Air Force Exchange guys. And all those diverse communities were able to teach everyone something. And the way that the briefs and debriefs are structured today is just eye-watering. And it's like a Top Gun flight every day in the fleet. Come a long way.
Being that this is an interesting rabbit hole, I'll keep digging in this direction because, when you mentioned about the birth of Top Gun, is that derived from our experience in Vietnam where during the 50s and the early 60s, the technologists had convinced everybody that speed and missiles were going to rule the day and technology was going to make the seat and hands and mind portion of the TAC air-to-air component meaningless. But of course, reality taught us a different lesson. And we've seen, I think the Air Force has had this pressure more than we've had in the Navy. There is a lot of pressure going back in that direction again towards technology, drones, AI, advances in BVR, et cetera, and so forth. Do you perceive that there is a danger as we go into the 2020s, repeating what happened in the 50s and the early 60s, where absent real-world peer-to-near-peer air-to-air competition, that the technologists and the theories will start to get more weight over what, for lack of better phrase, can be called practical experience?
We can see some of that happening in the F-35. The F-4 Navy F-4 Phantom did not have a gun. It had a big air-to-air radar, and the reason for that was it needed to go out into the, far from the carrier, that big powerful radar and see Soviet aircraft coming in and knock them down at range, and that was why. The F-14 and the FA-18 had an internal gun. The Navy F-35 Charlie does not, but the Air Force F-35 Alpha does. They demanded it. They also demand a 9G capability. which means, you got to, there's a penalty for that. The Navy F-35C isn't going to have that much G, but it's going to carry a lot more fuel and it'll have some other advantages. So, and then there's, as you mentioned, there's drones and there's electronic warfare all over the place. I think it's a trade-off. Certainly the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Navy, they have to look at the aircraft that's going to do what they need it to do for them. You can have a very reasonable argument, would we ever make another airplane that's going to one size fit all for three services? I personally hope that we don't. That the next time that we do this, I guess the follow-on to the FA-18, the ENF, can be a Navy aircraft, maybe Navy Marine Corps, but not necessarily Air Force. That's a tough one. And, you can never depend on technology. I mean, it's going to be taken away from you, first of all. And I write about that in Fight. It's going to be, and we're doing this today, we're going to be dropping a beanbag on the flight deck. And that message is going to, from one ship to the other. Blinking lights and we're going to go back to taking, sun lines with sextants. I believe that we're going to be able to do all those things, be prepared to do those things, but it's going to make it, we're used to our push button space age stuff. We're not going to have it.
Sun lines, man, it brings back my days as a navigator on a destroyer before we had GPS. That's how old I am. I think in the introduction to Fight, you talked about this. You said today's warriors on both sides depend on communications sensors and precise navigation assets that they will lose quite fast when the shooting starts. Now what? And the side that can adapt fastest has the best chance of victory. And I think that's just exactly what you were talking about. Is that right?
Yeah. Absolutely, our American personnel are trained. We are also, it's in our national cultural DNA to act. Okay, something's not working, so here I am. I'm a young junior officer. I'm a petty officer. I need to make a decision, and I'm not afraid to make one. That's kind of how we grow up. Cultures that we're fighting may not have that. Say, well, I better not make any move at all because I might get in trouble. Victor Davis Hanson is an author that I imagine you guys and many of your listeners have read. And he talks about this in his incredible book, Carnage and Culture, and how Western civilization has through the millennia done very well against non-Western cultures in warfare.
Yeah, we've actually had, it must have been maybe 5 years ago, we actually had Dr. Hanson on as a guest.
Oh, yeah, I've read anything he writes, I want to read.
Yeah, he's got a great mind, and you can tell he's really a farmer at heart, but the other side of his brain won't let him work too much. One thing I wanted to pull a thread on, knowing your biases with no slack and light attack and all, but back when you and I were kiddies, let's just throw a dart at really the A7 swan song, Desert Storm, where we actually, what was it, the America or the Saratoga that had pretty much a flight deck and nothing but A7s in the Red Sea? I can't
remember.
It was
John F. Kennedy. He had Kennedy. VA-46 and VA-72, yes.
Back then, when we were kids, when you looked at an air wing, you had great diversity there. You had the A6, the A7, not necessarily in the same air wing, but at the ramp at home, and you could custom build it from there. But in the toolbox, in addition to the A6, the A7, and the F-14, you had the sexy and new at the time, F-18, S-3, E-2s, EA-6s. And lo and behold, we're now in our dotage. And for positive reasons, and there's been a few things lost as well. The air wing has a fewer, less variety, less diversity, so to speak, in it. And there's been some compromises given up. And you mentioned also two things that everybody loves to talk about. That's the compromises of having the F-35 serve three mistresses. But there's also the F-A-X-X, the replacement for the F-18 or the follow-on, whatever you want to do it. If Kevin had 51% of a vote there as they were prioritizing, what are those things you would want prioritized in the F-A-X-X?
Well,
or do I have to pay a consulting
fee? Fuel comes to mind. I mean, and I talk about fuel in my novel. It's obviously very important to us on the ship. I remember when I went from the A7 to the Hornet, I guess, you know, the aircraft, the Hornet carried a little more than the A7, but just went through it a lot faster, obviously. But my F4 Phantom friends that came over to fly the Hornet said, "This is great. we got plenty of fuel." So I guess it's all relative. But certainly the electronic warfare piece, the sensors that we have now, that will be spiraled up, and new stuff will be invented. The weapons we have now, if you are seen in the visual arena, you're going to get shot. And, you know, you don't have to work your way behind a bandit like World War II and Korea and Vietnam, quite frankly. I think that, am I going to demand 9Gs? No. An internal gun, would love to have it, but you know, if I can make a trade-off there and get what I want as far as, fuel survivability, the electronic toys that I want to carry, that's important. I like to, read the trade press and blogs, and I'll pick up an idea that someone else, a great idea that someone else has, and I'll write a novel about it. I think that's probably my role here in this conversation.
Well, let's talk about that novel that, I'm looking forward, and I'm thinking, well, you know, we've got these unmanned tankers. I can't remember what their numbers are anymore.
The NQ-25.
NQ-25. Thank you. And I'm thinking, well, that's probably pretty cool. And I'm sure I'm reading all this stuff about unmanned, basically unmanned wingmen, where you're going to go out with an F-18, and he's going to have one or a couple of other aircraft with him that are unmanned, but are going to be doing important parts of the mission. How do you see that playing out down the road? Is this just going to complicate the air picture out there, or is there sense to be had in the way this is going?
People ask me that question. They say, you know, we got all this unmanned stuff. Why don't we just go unmanned? And I say, when will we fly our last manned fighter? And in my view, you know, that day will come probably this century, but in the second half of this century. And so for right now, there's terrific value in unmanned stuff. Unmanned, and the NQ-25, as it was designed back when I was in the Pentagon. This is going to do the dull, dangerous, and dirty missions that we needed to do. What is a dull mission? You know, the recovery tanker. That's what this aircraft is going to do. But the dangerous missions of going into a high threat environment, and going in there, you know, kicking down the door on day one, you know, maybe, you know, blasting open a path for even the F-35s and the Rhinos to follow. Okay. And then, dirty is chem bio, to fly in a chem bio environment when you're also kicking down the door. And if that's a threat, and to neutralize it, and then you bring in your bomb trucks later. I think that there's fire scouts right now in the fleet. that are on LCSs and destroyers. I imagine that they'll go out over the horizon and give the ship captain, the Commodore, some eyes and ears over that area of the horizon. And there's a weapons capability on that. All good. I think the helicopters and certainly P-8s today are going to be working very closely with unmanned assets on the fighter role. I'm waiting, and if that can be fielded about the next time I write again, I'll do it. What I like to do is write about what capabilities we have today, and not go into the future with all this whiz bang cool stuff. I mean, the reality is that we're going to fight with what we have today. Rumsfeld said this in the last decade: you go to war with the army you have, and he was vilified for it, but he spoke the truth. We know he spoke the truth. I mean, everyone says, well, we had this IED threat and something must be done. Well, something was done. I mean, billions of dollars are being spent as fast as we could spend it. When I was still in the building over 10 years ago to solve that problem. But we know that it can't be solved overnight. It takes years to build a ship and frankly, years to build an airplane. And it's not going to be like World War II where we're churning out all this stuff overnight.
The novels you've written, and I think one of the good things about it is the fact that you said there, these are real capabilities, real platforms, because sometimes you read something that the scenario is ripped from the headlines, but it's somewhere in the distant future where somebody found a pixie dust to make lasers work or something. And it's just like, that's just too easy of a fix to get around a really hard problem. But I wanted to go back to your novels for a second because I believe it was in April, the third in the series came up, and they all brought the lead character here in all three novels, Flip Wilson. For the listener, if they haven't read any of your novels, just for a second, talk about Flip, how you built the character, who he is, but also is this something that they could pick up number two or number three if they saw it, or do they really need to go back to the first novel in order to not miss any of the least character nuance?
Yeah, great question. Flip Wilson, he was introduced to the readers in Raven 1, and he is the operations officer in a Hornet squadron on deployment. And he's married with kids. I mean, oftentimes in novels like this, the protagonist, single guy running around having a great time and, bad attitude and, Maverick Mitchell, you know, the type, but here's Flip and, he's doing a good job as a department head. He's made a decision to stay, but he's on cruise again. He's on his fourth or fifth cruise and there's pressure from home that we've experienced, and I imagine, many of your listeners have too. There's pressure. You gotta keep going on these deployments. What about us back home? So you're fighting that. In Raven 1, Flip has a CO who he loves, and his XO is a homicidal maniac. So he's being pulled in that direction. He's trying to please both masters, if you will. It's a challenge being a department head in the squadron, in any squadron. When you're a lieutenant, not much is expected of you. And when you're a CO and XO, everyone's nice to you. When you're a department head, you're in that middle ground and it's tough. So that's where I started. To answer the second part of your question, they do not have to be read in order. They're all standalone. If you do read them in order, you'll pick up some things. You'll have some background on as Flip progresses in his career, but it is not a showstopper. Anyone could pick up Fight, and you get a good understanding of who Flip is.
Yeah, I want to thank you for Commander Prince, the XO, in your first book, in Raven 1, because even those of us who serve in the Black Shoe Navy have run guys who are I want to say political officers, because I don't mean that in the Soviet, former Soviet sense, but kind of guys getting their ticket punched and meant as they try and move up, but who are not necessarily the people you ever want to serve with. And I thought your characterization of that guy was pretty spot on to some people that I had an unfortunate encounter with along my way.
Thank you. And the character is Saint Patrick. A lot of people ask me about Saint. Many readers and most of my readers are look like me, to tell you the truth. Although there's a huge active duty contingent that read my novels, but the older guys will say, you know, I had an XO just like that. and I didn't. I never served with anyone that bad as I made Saint. But it's interesting that I get messages from readers that say, oh, no, my guy was just like him.
Yeah, the reason I went with Prince, I'm sorry, was I thought of him as a perfume prince, as we used to call him.
Yes.
In my world. and yeah, St. Patrick, that's right. So I apologize for that.
We all know different flavors of characters like that. I just had a flashback to one of my fellow department heads many moons ago. I'll go stick a needle in his picture later today. But one thing I wanted to ask you, Kevin, is you write in a certain genre, and I don't know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. But what are some, if not influences per se, but what are some other fiction writers that you enjoy reading and whose style you think may have influenced yours or at least inspired you?
Great, great question. I love to answer it. First one, Edward L. Beach, Captain Ned Beach, who wrote Run Silent, Run Deep, which I read as a kid. And, World War II, submarine fiction against a fictional nemesis in the Inland Sea of Japan. And he had there was a love triangle, and there was at a young age, I think my teenage years, saying, oh wow, there's friction like this in the Navy. My father was the Navy, I'm sure he would have said, oh yeah, let me tell you, but Edward L. Beach. Another one, Herman Wouk. Just a superstar, War Remembrance, The Winds of War, the Caine Mutiny, all must reads for officers. I've been Stephen Kuntz, Flight of the Intruder, and Final Flight. I think I mentioned, Final Flight at the beginning. I thought that was even a better work for me. I really enjoyed that. So the style, I guess, third person. You got this all-seeing narrator that's guiding you through the story. I'll tell you something. Writing sometimes my characters and I will just go someplace I had no idea. How did we get here? You just start writing, and the words are. What I do is I hack on the word processor on the computer, and then go back with a pen and paper and fix it, but. Wow, I don't know how we got here, but this is cool. And yeah, when that happens, it makes it fun. There's plenty of drudgery to this, but yeah, there's those good moments.
Yeah, I also enjoyed your. It's a very short piece. Your piece on the high desert as you looked out an airplane window over the area where the Navy Fighter Weapons School is, and you really captured, I think, the area and the importance of that much space for the people who are going through that process. Talk a little bit about that space and why so much room is needed for the Fighter Weapons School people.
Fallon, Nevada, Aviators Disneyland. you know, wide open spaces. Everything, you know, visual flight rules just take off, and you know, clear skies almost all the time, and you're dropping big heavy live bombs, shooting real rockets, you're strafing everything, and popping over ridge lines. Just what a blast. Okay, so yes, each deployment, prior to deployment, the air wing will go out there and train together as an air wing. Under the auspices of today, essentially Top Gun instructors, and to get the air wing ready in the tactical arena. So you ask, you know, why do they need such open spaces? Well, you know, that's the reality of today. We talked about, you know, in the air-to-air arena, you know, if you can see something, that's you can probably shoot it. And of course, there's beyond visual range capability as well. So you need wide open spaces and to do the maneuvering that you want. I mean, we're talking. It's a long. I mean, I'm not sure how far it is, but it's a lot of airspace and it's supersonic airspace. Much of it, you know, over land. That's very rare. So this is 2005 again, and I'm newly retired. Now I'm a defense consultant, and I'm flying to Fallon because my client has this new widget that's going to make tactical aviators' lives easier. So we're going to go out there and get some bottom-up support for it. So, and I chose the left side of the airplane because I knew that, you know, coming from Salt Lake City to Reno, knew how the airspace was going to go, and I'd be able to see it. You know, we'll talk about this now. You don't want an airplane anymore, and I prefer the window seat. I always try to get it, but I find that no one else is looking out the window. All the shades are down. They're on their screens. They're doing whatever they're doing, watching what the airline's showing them, and no one's looking out the window. I find it fascinating. So anyway, I'm looking out the window and wow, there it is. There's the Edwards Valley. You know, there's the Dixie Valley. You know, remember that time with Billy Bob and the Dixie Valley and the memories come back. So that's what I did. And just kind of a little autobiographical, and wow, what a great life that was.
Yeah, I find that a little frustrating too, especially now with all the electronic distractions available in the airplane. You can look around and nobody's looking out the window, and especially if you're flying from coast to coast, flying over the American West on a clear bluebird day, it's just beautiful, especially at altitude. But you know, you can't make people enjoy life if they want to.
Yeah, you think about you know, all the history down there. You know, the pioneers across the wilderness, of course, and a path to freedom beat and everything. Just an observation.
One thing I wanted to. One part of your background that you shared with me is kind of unique. And we've talked a little bit about some of the really big pixel issues, but I wanted to bring one up is you're an old Jack's Mafia guy. Spent a lot of time in Cecil Field, those big, beautiful, wide, parallel and perpendicular runways over in the pine forest west of Jacksonville that the Imperial we lost in the post-Cold War BRAC, and everybody got shoehorned into Oceania and very crowded airspace. The local people in Virginia are not the local people in Virginia from 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago who are a little more welcoming. And in a few places, Institute's one of them, good people I like over there, but they know how to trigger me because they want to push for another BRAC to consolidate into more super bases in fewer locations. As somebody that has a lot of experience and knows Cecil and knows and saw what we lost when it came to training spaces and redundant capabilities in the last BRAC, what do you say to those that think it's time for another BRAC online with what we saw in the 1990s?
you know, I was at Cecil in 1993, and you know, BRAC was in the news, and I guess there was a delegation from Washington come down, and Cecil was just chock full of Hornets, chock full of S3s. There's airplanes flying around all over the place all the time, and you know, a year later, okay, Cecil's getting BRAC. The Navy gave it the office in the 90s. You know, the Navy had four master jet bases and gave away two of them, gave away Cecil and Miramar. And, of course, now the Marines, they moved from El Toro to Miramar, so that's still there. But the Navy gave away a lot in those years. Now, what was also going on? The Navy was hunkering down after the Tailhook scandal. And so, okay, look, yeah, we're going to give away all this stuff, and there wasn't a whole lot of fighting going on. In Jacksonville specifically, there was a long-serving congressman, and I'm going to guess his name, but I might be wrong, so I'm not going to guess, but a very long-serving and powerful appropriations congressman had just retired. Congresswoman Tilly Fowler, a great American, but you know she's a freshman congressman. And did not, you know, she'd been on the job 2 months, and Cecil was identified as on the BRAC list. And she had no political clout at that time. Not her fault, not blaming her one bit. I can't remember how hard the state of Florida fought. And I don't think it was very hard, because in Jacksonville, Duval County, there's Naval Air Station Jacksonville. It's on the St. John River. Everyone sees it. It's a vital, you know, the Fleet Readiness Center. You know, we called it NARF back in those days. You know, employing tens of thousands of people, and then of course Mayport, the harbor, the ships, carriers, plural, and there's that base out on the west side, out in the sticks, Cecil, and they fly their noisy jets, yeah, whatever, and so there wasn't a lot of political will even in Jacksonville at the time. I mean, if you're going to take away a base, you know, not Jacksonville, not Mayport. So yes, you know, we have our fleet concentration areas, and so what are we going to do? Are we going to we're going to get out of the Puget Sound and put everything in San Diego, you know, get out of Pearl Harbor and put everything, you know, someplace else? Are we going to close Mayport and put everything in Hampton Roads? And that's not smart. So we need to have sort of some geographic diversity. Those bases that I just described, they can all stand on their own. As far as importance, I do not believe that the Navy needs to BRAC or should BRAC, and I can't speak for the other services.
Well, yeah. Speaking of legislative matters, let's talk a little bit about your affiliation with the Tailhook Association and your responsibilities in that organization, because I think this may tie into what you just talked about.
Yes. After I retired, I was approached by my buddy Captain Scott Swift, who had a pretty successful career, and he was the president at Tailhook at the time. And I had just left legislative affairs. You'd be great for our vice president of legislative affairs. So I served that. I just stepped down a couple months ago from that role at Tailhook, but a wonderful organization. You know, it's time for someone else to get in there, but Tailhook is an outstanding service organization. You know, the Tailhook Education Foundation every year is giving hundreds of thousands of dollars in scholarship monies to some outstanding students. Many of them are on active duty, but certainly coming out of high school. You go to a Tailhook convention, it is a trade show at heart. And Naval Aviation Leadership is there en masse. You know, dozens of senior leaders, and they may or may not be wearing stars. Program managers and ship captains, and so industry is there because they know that they can get a few minutes with a decision maker that they like to see. But it's also a wonderful time to see buddies you haven't seen in years. It is full of spouses. You see little kids in strollers. A couple months ago, some guy, the PAC Fleet Pilot of the Year. So he goes up to get his award with his wife and baby. You know, and she's got a little newborn baby in her arms. And yeah, it's certainly not what the public thinks how the organization is perceived. But not very, very proud of what Tailhook is doing. Tailhook is reaching out and has had great success with the helicopter community. The helicopter community, the rotoring, is certainly part of Naval Shipboard Aviation. And they have the Naval Helicopter Association, and they do great work there, but they are absolutely welcome, and they feel welcome at Tailhook. They have rotary wing aviators on the Tailhook board. So it's a good thing to see.
Now, speaking of as you mentioned earlier, you just stepped off as Vice President of Legislative Affairs there, and you also have spent some time in D.C., and this is a question that through the years I like to ask our guests where appropriate. And I want to get your opinion as well, is when it comes to the interests of Navy, you know, maybe naval aviation, may not. Opinion makers are important. People in uniform are important. Industry people are important. But at the end of the day, if you don't have a funding line, you don't have anything. So you really need advocates up at the Hill. And the situation with BRAC in the 90s, with the transition from Charlie Bennett to Tilly Fowler, that's also when Corrine Brown came, they added an extra district. But
yes.
you need to have advocates in the House and Senate who not are just advocates, but they know what you're talking about. They understand the language, the lingo, and where the levers of power are. Who are those people up at the Hill in Congress and the Senate, naval and those who are really concerned about the naval power of the U.S., they can look to as advocates in the legislative branch?
I'll answer this. I guess my initial thought on that is professional staffers in authorization and appropriations. And the way that this works is the authorizations committee, House and Senate, they can authorize. See, we authorize 24 FA-18 Echoes to be built in fiscal next year. And the appropriators can say, okay, yeah, we're going to write a check for 36 FA-18s, or we're going to write a check for 20. And you know, they've got the checkbook, the appropriation. So that, getting those professional staffers who have the ear of those committee chairmen is important. So when I was in legislative affairs, our role was on the authorization side. And I spent a lot of time with professional staffers, taking them, you know, around the country to places like St. Louis, Fort Worth, Newport News, Huntington Ingalls. And you know, there's industry, talking to the industry guys and getting the real deal. On the appropriation side of the house, they had their own legislative branch that did that for them. Really important, don't cross the streams. But you needed buy-in from all those guys. Today, right now, I'd be guessing. Because the defense consulting I'm doing now is more on the business development side than the budget line. But I enjoyed going into a member's office, and there's always a 24-year-old every year that the staffer's 24 years old, and had no background, but had a question about naval aviation for some reason, maybe from a constituent or because their boss is on the committee and wanted to understand. And I enjoyed, walking them through why that we have to keep buying these ships and these airplanes and what they do. They had no background, but they were pretty quick on the uptake, and they appreciated that. The professional staffers looked more like me, with gray hair. And they knew where the bodies were buried over decades, and they could tell you, they were there from the beginning of the F-14 program till the end, and knew all about it and why monies were spent. So I enjoyed that tour. And then on the Monday after I retired, I went in as a defense consultant, and it was pretty much the exact same thing I was doing when I was in uniform. Very, very, very similar work. The only difference was I would go to a fundraiser and hand someone a check. That was the only difference.
Well, this has been quick, but have you got another book in the works you want to talk about here? Or can we be looking forward to something from you here in the near future?
Absolutely. I have finished my fourth novel, and here flips on shore duty, but here I've gone back to June 1942, and I've lectured on the Battle of Midway for many years. It's a passion of mine. It's just a fascinating battle. What really happened there. So I've written a historic fiction novel about the Battle of Midway. My working title is The Silver Waterfall, and I'm going to approach it like Michael Shara did with The Killer Angels. I haven't changed any facts. It's about real men who fought it, and then I can do my thing with the dialogue and what's going through their minds. Just like Cher did. So I'm really excited about it. Hope we can get it done and available to you readers on June 4th of next year. That's the goal.
Well, Kevin, that gives everybody something to look forward to in 2020. It's been a great hour. Really enjoyed talking to you and appreciate you taking time to come on and spend some time with us.
Really enjoyed it, guys. A terrific, terrific podcast. Enjoy your commentaries. Best wishes.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today.
And thank you everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. And until next time, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Goddamn.